Okay. We have come to spirit. So does it start? Or
maybe I was going to introduce you for those,
yeah,
for those people who don't know you. So welcome. Welcome evening. And as well from this hours, are you going to start with a short meditation, maybe guided meditation? That's how we usually start our
evenings. Yeah, meetings. Of course we can. Yeah.
Yeah.
How long?
Maybe 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. En er zijn ook mensen die graag vertalingen willen leggen. Die zijn nog altijd hier, of is het niet mogelijk? Wie wil er graag vertalingen? Kunnen die mensen even hun hand? Ja, zeg maar een taak, oké. Goed zo. Some people would like some translations, so I'll do that. Ik was van plan om met jou dan aan die voor te stellen. Ik zal het misschien heel kort doen. Op 20-jarige leeftijd, tijdens een bezoek aan Japan, raakte hij geïnteresseerd in boeddhisme en meditatie. Hij studeerde voor ingenieur en begon zijn kloosterpleiding als Samajarika, of thuisloze in Amaravati, een Chitvers Buddhist Monastery in Engeland. Na het volgen van het onderricht van Ajahn Brahm, of Ajahn Brahm Alonso, reisde hij naar dienstklooster in Australië, Bodhinyana Monastery, om te trainen onder leiding van Ajahn Brahm. Hij woont in een Bodhinyana klooster sinds 1994 en werd toen door Ajahn Brahm tot monnik gewijd. Hij is nu 20 jaar monnik en verkreeg de titel Mahathera, Great Elder. Hij staat bekend om zijn grote kennis van de Pali-taal en de sutras, toespraken van de Boeddha. Hij is auteur van verschillende boeken over het vroege boeddhisme. Ik denk dat dat volstaat als introductie.
Oké, so let's do some attention to it. Yes, let's start from that then. Okay, so just close your eyes. And make sure you're nice and comfortable after you close your eyes. It's nice to shut out the world a little bit, and one of the things you notice when you close your eyes is how much of the sense impressions are shut out, and how straight away you have more sense of awareness of other things, like the body, for example. So feel the body a little bit, and make sure that we start off by being comfortable and also being relaxed and at ease in the body there. Please always make sure that when you start off the meditation, always take enough time to really relax and feel at ease. Because as you do that, not only does the body relax, but the mind relaxes as well. The two are so closely connected with each other that if you relax one, you also relax the other. as you relax the body in this way, and it is really a part of compassion and kindness towards yourself. And in the very real sense, you're looking after yourself when you do this. And this attitude of looking after yourself with kindness and compassion, and this is the sort of attitude that allows you to relax further there. It takes you into the state of mindfulness itself. Mindfulness is what happens when you turn the present moment into the pleasant moment. Please notice that process as things become more easy and relaxed and happy and positive. You can actually feel your mind gradually emerging into the present moment as a consequence. As you find that the mind comes into the present moment, what you find yourself becoming a bit like a passenger on a train or whatever. And when you are a passenger, you're no longer involved in driving the vehicle. All you do is sit back and enjoy the scenery in the window. That's all you can do. You have no control anymore. This is the idea of mindfulness arising, and sitting back and allowing phenomena to pass along. And you just observe them. You are not involved, but just allow things to be. head. The topic, or tonight's topic is commitment and perseverance in one's practice. And I will give you one secret straight away. Usually what I do, I give a long talk, right, at the very end, I tell you what it's supposed to do. That must come straight at the beginning, yeah? Just to kind of make it more interesting to start with that. One of the most important secrets of being able to commit and persevere in your practice, in your spiritual practice, whatever you consider that, one of the foundational things is to enjoy what you're doing. Yeah? And this is one of the things you find, especially in meditation practice, if you enjoy the meditation, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have tremendous bliss and tremendous happiness and these kind of things, but you have at least a little bit of contentment, a little bit of enjoyment of the peace, a little bit of benefit out of what we're doing here. And if you have that little bit of enjoyment from the meditation practice, then it will be possible to persevere and commit for these things in the long term. Remember the point of a spiritual path. A spiritual path is not like a thing that you do quickly and you finish with. A spiritual path is something that ideally you keep on that, yeah, over the weeks, over the months, over the years, sometimes, unfortunately, over the lifetimes, yeah? But sometimes it kind of keeps on going for a long time. And to be able to do that the only way you're going to be able to do that, to commit to that extent, that is if you enjoy what you're doing. It is so important. And this is then, in meditation practice, very important. So try to find that enjoyment, learn to relax, learn to be at peace, learn to kind of not to have too much pain in the body, and look for those beautiful qualities in the meditation that makes the meditation attractive. So this is the first part of where enjoyment should be found. I would also recommend you to find enjoyment in basic things in the practice, like just being moral and virtuous, yeah, having a sense of sila. Try to find the happiness in being kind. Find the happiness in being virtuous and being generous. And if you can see the happiness in that, it becomes a very powerful motivation for actually being able to sustain the sila in the long term. And sustaining sila is not something that is tremendously important if you want results in the long run. So if you can see the happiness in that, it's going to be a very powerful source of commitment in the path. How do we do that? How do you see happiness in sila? It sounds like some kind of a restraint, right? Constraint. We have to keep rules. These days, people don't want to keep rules. They don't want to keep rules. Rules are kind of they hinder my freedom. I can't do what I want. Of course, it's a complete misunderstanding. The reality is that if you keep certain rules, it actually increases the freedom. Because the freedom that it hinders is a certain freedom of actions. You can't kind of go out to the bar maybe at night or whatever. Big deal, right? I'm going to the bar at night. But the freedom that it encourages, you can't do certain things, you can't kill things, you can't kill someone, right? It's not kind of a tremendously important freedom. You don't kind of actually need that sort of freedom. But what it gives you instead, of course, very interesting, it gives you a mental freedom, an internal freedom, because you are free from the oppressions of so many of these defilements of the mind. Actually, I like a slave driver, yeah, inside a mental slave driver, and that is what we have been free from. So actually, there is a freedom in keeping morality and keeping precepts and all of these kind of things. So notice that freeing up of the mind. The mind is less enthralled to the defilement and the problems of the mind. And instead, if you feel like you're not being driven so strongly by ill will, by desire, and these things that are like slave drivers, and you're just going around like a sheep, yeah? You think, yes, master, slave, I will go wherever you want to take me, and just follow along where the slave master takes you. So this is number one. The second thing that I would recommend you to focus on when it comes to happiness and sila is to feel the results of what you're doing. Notice what happens when you do an act of kindness. And this is when the Buddha talks about karma, he talks about karma in three different ways. Karma that gives results in this very life, karma that gives results in the next life, and karma that gives results beyond that. So this is really what is meant by karma in this very life. The idea that if you do an act of kindness now, and you feel what an act feels like, it feels good. I'm sure all the people know about that, because this is so obvious for anyone who's kind of trying to live a good life. You do an act of kindness, you say something friendly to somebody, yeah? You do an act of charity, yeah? And sometimes all you have to do is take a kind thought, like a thought of metta, a thought of friendship. And if you feel the result of that straight away, it makes you feel good inside, yeah? You feel, yeah, that was the right thing to do, I feel good about myself. You feel a sense of integrity, you feel a sense of wholesomeness about your person. And that is a very beautiful and powerful thing to feel on the path. So try to tap into that, try to feel the power of sila. At the same time, also notice the power of bad sila, yeah, whenever you say something which isn't quite right. And also how you feel afterwards, you're kind of regretting that. You feel a bit kind of dodgy about that. You don't feel very kind of that, you know, it doesn't make you feel happy at all. When you see these things, see the happiness of the path, it strengthens your commitment and your ability to keep these things. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there, so please, please go ahead.
Het onderwerp van deze Dhammapak was toewijding en doorzetting op het in de praktijk. En ik zal beginnen met een grote geheim in plaats van het tot het einde te bewaren, zich dan in. En dat is genieten van wat je doet. Vreugde, tevredenheid is een voorwaarde en leidt naar toewijding. Het spirituele pad is een toewijding die van lange termijn op lange termijn. En dat kan je ook, kan je alleen maar doen als je het fijn vindt. Je ziet dan kijken naar de mooie kwaliteiten die de meditatie oefening je brengen. Probeer vreugde en geluk te zien of te vinden in sila, in moraliteit. De meeste mensen vinden het niet fijn om zich te houden aan de regels, die beperkingen en vrijheid, die voldoen wat ik wil. Hoe kan je het geluk zien dat sila brengt? Wel, het is eigenlijk het tegenovergestelde. Deze regels brengen in een immense vrijheid. De mentale slavernij, waar we het slachtoffer van zijn, daar worden we vrij van en dat is vrijheid. Dus moraliteit betekent eigenlijk dat we de slavendrijver die de geest is, niet volgen. En dan had Dante het over karma. Hij zei, karma de wet van oorzaak en gevolg. Hij zei, er is karma in dit leven. En we voelen bijvoorbeeld onmiddellijk, als we woorden spreken of handelingen stellen die komen vanuit vriendelijkheid, dan voel je dat effect onmiddellijk. Probeer de kracht van positieve moraliteit, maar ook van negatieve moraliteit te voelen en te zien. Dat kan je bijvoorbeeld heel duidelijk zien als je boos bent op mensen of als je negatief praat tegen mensen. Dan voel je onmiddellijk je gevolgen daarvan.
So that is the that's the easy part, that's kind of the giveaway at the beginning. And now this is kind of the deeper look at how commitment and perseverance comes about. So that was it. Kind of the if you take that much away, maybe you can use that. Wonderful. If you take the second thing away, maybe even better, yeah? So this is kind of the idea here. So the second thing I want to start off very briefly, talk a little bit about what Buddhism really is. Often people ask the question, what is Buddhism? Is Buddhism a philosophy? Is it a religion? Is it a psychology? What exactly is it? How does it fit into this modern concept that we have about such things? The first thing to understand is that the Buddhist teaching actually is not, from my point of view, is not really a philosophy at all. The Buddha's teaching is fairly easy to understand, but it's not that difficult. The basic principles can be summarized fairly simply in such things as kindness and that sort of thing. And you don't need kind of a PhD in philosophy or whatever to understand the Buddha's teachings, so, which is good, because otherwise we'd be in serious trouble if that, that was a requirement. This is an important point. It is not what that means, is that they don't actually need to spend an enormous amount of time on study, on reading, and trying to understand these teachings. It's quite common in the Western world, we find people who are the philosophizing Buddhists. Yeah, who like to think about Buddhism, dependent origination, 12 things. I wonder how these things actually connect together. Avijja, Acchaya, Sankhara, right? Ignorance at the beginning, of delusion, is the cause, the condition for Sankhara, the volitional activities. That is the course of consciousness. And these things are very kind of easy to get, start to get to philosophize about these things, because the conditionality between these things can be quite complex in many different ways. But it's important to remember that Buddha's teaching is not actually a philosophy. It is meant to be pragmatic, to be a part of practice, and not something to think about very much. Remember, there's a very nice place in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha, where the Buddha talks about this. And this is a sutta which I've quoted quite a few times, actually, in the last few days. And this is a sutta where the Buddha is in a place called the Singsapagrava. And it's a very famous simile used in the suttas. Well, the Buddha takes up a handful of leaves in his hand, and he says to his monks, he says, "The leaves I have in my hand, is that more? Or are all the leaves on the trees above here, are they more?" And the monks say, okay. Very obvious answer, right? The leaves in hand are very few, and of course the leaves above are very many, so not really meant as a very serious question. And the Buddha says, well, exactly in the same way as the leaves in my hand are few, in the same way those teachings that I've taught you are few compared to those that understanding that I've awakened to through my awakening is vastly more than that, just like the leaves overhead in the grove overhead. Why is it that I've only taught you a small amount of what I understood, what I know? What is the reason for that? And he gives a beautiful answer. The answer is that those things that I've taught you, those are the practical things. These are the four noble truths. These are the things that lead to nirvana, to extinguishment, to cessation, to all these things at the end of the path. These are the things I have taught you, the pragmatic things, the practical things, those things that really matter. All those other things that I haven't taught you, that I know about, like the leaves overhead in the forest, there are so many here. Those are the things that I have not taught you. Why? Because they don't really lead to that destination. So what are those things in the trees? Yeah, all the things that the Buddha knows about, that he has understood, what are they? Wouldn't that be quite exciting to know? Wouldn't that be interesting? If he has seen the truth, right? If he has seen the reality of things, and he has seen all these leaves on the trees there, it would be really cool, right, to know about all of that. He only gives us a few leaves. That's really unfair. We want to know everything. Yeah, anyone else want to know those things? Yeah, well, just me. Yeah, well, that's good, okay. And this is exactly the problem, right? This is precisely the problem. The problem is that we are too interested in all of those things that are so interesting. Philosophy, how the world is constructed, how it all works together. It actually is very exciting, and it excites our restless mind, our inquiring mind. We want to know all of these issues. And whether it actually has anything to do with the path or not, it's not so important, right? Our mind kind of craves that kind of feeling of being satisfied by knowledge and satisfied by systems and satisfied by how everything kind of fits together in this way. And so I think the Buddha, he realized that the human mind needs, you know, not to be kind of too sidetracked by all these philosophical issues. And because of that, he actually kept things to the bare minimum. You get what you need to be able to practice the path. But the other stuff we leave it aside because it is a distraction. I know I would have been distracted, right? One of the back there agrees, also he would also be distracted by that. The rest of you are silent, I'm not sure what that means, but I think maybe it means you might be distracted a little bit as well. That's what I suspect it means. So this then is the reason why the Buddha kept the early suttas so simple. And this is one of the things that is interesting when you look at Buddhist history. That when you look at Buddhist history, you look at those teachings that the Buddha taught very early on, and that is what you now find in the four main Nikayas. Do you know a little bit about the Buddhist sutras? Four Nikayas, long discourse of the Buddha, mid-length discourse of the Buddha, no? Connected. Okay, these are the basic kind of discourses of the Buddha, right? They're the long, mid-length, connected, and numerical discourses of the Buddha. So keep those names in mind, because they're actually quite useful names to remember. And if you want to know what the Buddha taught, that is where you really want to go. These are the earliest part of the sutras, really, of the word of the Buddha. And what is interesting in Buddhist history, soon after the Buddha passed away, what started to happen was that Buddhist literature started to develop. Yeah, and one of the first things you started to get after the Buddha was passed away was that monks started thinking, wait a minute, the Buddha didn't say everything. He left some gaps, right? It's not a complete philosophy here. There are things missing here. We don't understand the relationship here between this and that. There seems to be some mental factors that we're talking about over here now. We've got to sort it out. We've got to fill in the gaps. We can't keep gaps in the system. That's terrible. Right? It's that the human restless mind wants to fill in, wants to kind of sort things out and make sure everything is nice and complete. And from that restlessness of the human mind emerged one of the first kind of large constructs in Buddhism, which is the Abhidhamma teachings. You heard about Abhidhamma? Yeah? Abhidhamma is one of these kind of large things. It has seven massive, enormous books. The last one is called the Patthana. It's the biggest book in the Abhidhamma, and it has full of little dots in it, triple dots, right? Ellipsis points, where the text is contracted. And somebody said that if you filled in all those ellipsis points, the book would be so long that it would stretch from over 1,000 kilometers. That's how big that book would be. So the spine of the book would be 1,000 kilometers long, right? That is how long it would be. And this is kind of the scale of this kind of philosophical project. It's absolutely enormous if you look at it. And this is what happens when you start to go into philosophy. And this is precisely the problem. This is exactly why the Buddha's teaching is not a philosophy. It is a pragmatic path to get you from point A to point B. I think the most accurate description of the Buddha's teaching is a psychology. Because it is about learning how to deal with the mind, to deal with the mind that leads to happiness and a decline in suffering. Yeah? This is what it's all about. How do we look at the world? How do we think about things? How do we perceive things? How do we act and speak in such a way that it leads to our own contentment, happiness, compassion, friendliness, reduction in suffering, peace, all of these beautiful qualities, and a decline in all the bad ones. That is what the Buddha's teaching is about. So the correct way of looking at it is as a psychology. That's a great relief. We don't have to read all that much. We don't have to kind of, the study part of Buddhism actually is relatively simple. There's a few things that are useful to read, like the early word of the Buddha, especially in condensed form. It is very useful to read that. But beyond that, you don't have to worry too much about that. That is not the hard part of Buddhism. The hard part of Buddhism is something else. I can believe you're hanging there. I'm not going to let Paul translate that first of all.
Wat is boeddhisme? Is het een filosofie? Is het een religie? Wel, dan kan ik zeggen dat boeddhisme geen filosofie is. Boeddhisme is niet moeilijk om te begrijpen. En het is ook niet nodig om heel lang te studeren. En om heel veel energie te steken in studie. Het is pragmatisch. En het is niet zozeer iets om veel over te denken. De Boeddha gaf zelf een eenvoudig metafoor. Hij zei, kijk, ik heb hier enkele bladeren van bomen in mijn hand. En van wat zijn de lineaire van dus de bladeren die ik hier in mijn hand houd, of de bladeren die aan de boom hangen. En uiteraard waren er dus de meeste bladeren die aan de boom hingen. En dan zijn de woorden wel dit is wat ik jullie heb onderricht, wat ik jullie heb onderwezen, dit is de taal. En er zijn veel meer dingen die ik zou kunnen zeggen, maar die ik bewust niet zeg. En waarom niet? Omdat ze niet leiden naar die banen, omdat ze niet leiden naar ons geluk. Datgene wat ik onderricht is heel praktisch. En wat zijn de dingen die door die bladeren die dan in de boom hangen? De dingen die de Boeddha niet heeft onderricht, het is heel verleidelijk om daar over te speculeren en om naar dieper op in te gaan. En dat is precies het probleem. We zijn te zeer geïnteresseerd in dingen die onze rusteloze geest opwinden en voeden. De menselijke geest, het is niet nodig dat de menselijke geest op een dwaalspoor wordt gebracht door de zinloze informatie. En datgene wat de Boeddha heeft gezegd en wat in de eerste sutras, in de eerste toespraken staat, neergeschreven, is heel eenvoudig, heel simpel. Deze sutras zijn de basis. Nadat de Boeddha overleed, waren er mensen die de zogenaamde lege plekken in zijn onderricht wilden opvullen. En deze rusteloze geesten produceren zoiets als de Abhidhamma, het filosofisch systeem, wat enorm groot is. Dat is wat je krijgt als je gaat filosoferen, dat is eindeloos. Maar het leven van de Boeddha is heel praktisch, heel simpel, heel pragmatisch. Ik noem het filosofie, zegt Dante. Sorry, een psychologie, geen filosofie, maar psychologie. En we hoeven er niet zoveel over te lezen. Dat is niet het harde of het moeilijke deel van de Boeddha's teaching. Dat is niet het moeilijke deel van het onderricht van de Boeddha, de studie. Er is iets anders wat veel moeilijker is en dat gaat hij nu zeggen.
So, what is the hardest thing of the Buddhist path? That we all know that if we practice this path in the right way, we will all eventually reach awakening, right? The end of the path is awakening here. It's this insight into the nature of reality, understanding how everything is, and by doing that, eliminating all suffering and attaining the highest happiness. It's a pretty good deal, right? It sounds pretty good. It sounds very attractive, so we all kind of want to move in that direction, of course. It sounds really nice. But, of course, the problem is that we don't get there, yeah? The vast majority of people agree that this is very attractive. We'd like to go to the highest happiness. We have the teachings there. We know what we're supposed to do. And somehow, we still, most of us, most people, don't actually end up being arahants or awakened beings in this life. But why is that then? Why doesn't this happen then? And the answer is very simple. The answer is down to these two words that this is all about, commitment and perseverance in the practice. This is the real problem, huh? And this is the thing that is really hard to do in the Buddhist teachings. All the reading, all the studying is peanuts. You might not have to be, as I said before, you don't have to do that too much. Little knowledge is always good, but not too much. This is really the hard part, and what we really need to focus on, therefore, is how we can bring about that commitment, and from that commitment also the perseverance in the practice. So, the first thing I want to talk about is just a little bit about exactly what do we mean by commitment? Where should that commitment be? Where should the perseverance be? And the most important part as a foundation for the entire Buddhist path, and I spoke about that a bit this morning as well, is of course is in the area of sila, the area of morality and ethics. This is by far the most important thing in the Buddhist practice. It may sound very basic, but actually Buddhist morality and ethics is very profound and very broad. It involves a large number of factors, and if we can practice the Buddhist morality fully, then everything else tends to fall into place as a consequence. Everything else just tends to happen there. Yeah? So what we really need to do is we need to commit ourselves to the ethics of Buddhism, or to the ethics of Buddhism really, the Dhamma, moment to moment to moment, day after day, week after week, year in, year out. And as we do that, if we have an ability to make this so important, we are so committed, we persevere to this extent, driving morality, that we do it pretty much moment to moment all the time, then the results of the path are going to come very, very quickly. This is what we need to do. And just to briefly to summarize what I was saying this morning about ethics again, because this is such an important point. And for those of you who weren't here, I'm not exactly sure who was here, who wasn't anywhere, I've lost count. But anyway, so just to summarize again. So in Buddhism, of course, there are the things that we are supposed to avoid, which is bad actions by body, not to kill any living being, not to steal, of course, and not to commit kind of sexual misconduct. These are the three kind of bad actions of body. You have the bad speech, lying, of course, number one, Then we have the divisive speech, where you divide people, you kind of create enemies between people, you have harsh speech, where you speak in an unpleasant way, and you have the idle speech, Idle speech. Oh, I've heard about the kind of celebrities, that kind of stuff, So these are the negative aspects of morality in Buddhism. But what is interesting in Buddhist morality, in this way, is quite different from the way we normally think about morality in the West. It is not just about the things we're supposed to avoid, it's also about the things we're supposed to do. So not only should we avoid killing living beings, we should actively have compassion towards living beings. We should help them, we should support them. When we see somebody in a difficult situation, we should try to do something to help them out. That's the positive side of morality. If we shouldn't just avoid stealing, we should be actively generous. Generosity is one of these very powerful aspects of the Buddhist path. And the idea of generosity is not that you have to be generous in any particular area of life, but you should have this general attitude of always being willing to be generous and share and help out with people around you whenever you have the opportunity. It's this openness of heart, whereby you are willing to help out and share and be generous to the people around you. That general openness of the heart is what really matters here. And that will move you very rapidly towards meditation practice as well. And so that we can see here the negative side and the positive side, The same thing with speech. We shouldn't just avoid lying, but we should be deliberately truthful in how we say things. In other words, we shouldn't try to deceive in any way whatsoever. We shouldn't just not be divisive, we should try to bring harmony to people, unify people, bring people together. When we see there is a problem in our society, now has become so divided, in so many different ways, divided between rich and poor, between one nation and another one, between one nationality and another nationality, between male and female, educated and uneducated. There's some divided right now, politically divided as well, of course, always. Instead of actually building up that fire and making it worse, just try to have more harmony with each other, to work more together. When we have harmony, we can actually build up a more prosperous society because we're working together in a beautiful way. When you have harmony, you feel good, right? It's nice to be in harmony with your family and the people around you. When you're in disharmony with the people who are close to you, it feels terrible. You can't really be peaceful. You can't meditate. All of those things completely fall apart. So you create that harmony, especially with those people who are close to you. Not only should we avoid harsh speech, we should try to speak gently and kindly. I was saying yesterday, there's a really nice word for Pali, Kanna Sukha. Kanna Sukha means ear happiness. You just speak the ear happiness words, so the ear is happy. Oh, thank you very much for that kind speech. That is one of those nice big words in there. It somehow stands out. It also says in the Pali, it says that Hadaya Gamma. Hadaya Gamma means going to the heart. Just like we say in English, right? Speech goes to the heart because it feels good in the same way. And the last one, instead of mind chatter, we try to talk about things that are sensible, things that are valuable, things that people treasure. Beautiful word, like the word of the Buddha, these kind of things. And when we do that, then we are, this is the way to fulfill Buddhist morality. And the power of it is that if you avoid doing the negative things, you have no sense of remorse, you have no regret. You don't think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You think, actually, you don't think that at all. So you don't have that suffering, which is regret. But by deliberately doing good actions, you actually feel good about yourself. You think, wow, I did that. Yeah, I was generous. I helped somebody out. And you feel good about yourself. And this is a quality that the Buddha actually encourages us to develop. It's actually perfectly good. It's a positive thing to feel good about yourself when you have done something good. You're allowed to feel that. I don't know what it is like in Belgium, but in some kind of Western society, maybe the English are really bad about this, but you're not supposed to feel good about yourself, yeah? You do things, but you don't kind of make anything out of it. You are supposed to feel good about yourself. I did something good. It's not a bragging, egocentric kind of goodness. It's the quiet goodness of your heart when you feel content with your own conduct. That is what it's about. So you can see here how you're lifting yourself up. You're cutting off those big weights that are holding you down, the weights of the bad actions. And you're filling this balloon with helium, right? That's all the good actions. You're filling it up. And as you do that, you soar up. The mind soars. The mind becomes light, beautiful, bright as you do this. And it's a wonderful feeling when you see that happen inside of yourself. You see you're going from the stage which was not so happy, not so bright, moving towards brightness and happiness in your life. It's a wonderful thing, eh? So this is what morality does to you, eh? There's another aspect of morality. This is just the beginning. I told you Buddha is a lot about morality, but it's very interesting in this respect. The last one is the morality of the mind. Yeah, the mind itself is an area of morality, eh? So we need to also deal directly with how we use our mind as well, eh? We need to overcome the negative things in the mind. Anger, ill will in particular, this is the main area. We can also perhaps reduce craving a little bit. That's secondary. The main thing is to reduce anger and ill will because it's so destructive. And on the other hand, to develop the good side of the mind. Thoughts of kindness towards others. Yeah, we have a sense of friendliness towards others. Yeah? We build that up. And as we build that up, we're also building up the mental side of things as well. Yeah? Perhaps you think it is very hard to overcome anger. Yeah? Perhaps you think it is very difficult to develop a sense of friendliness towards others. It is not that hard. Yeah? Just come next time, come on my retreat, and I will tell you how to do this. It's exciting. This is kind of a preview of the next retreat coming up. What is my next retreat happening? Next 5 times or this 5 times?
Next
year. Okay, we'll see what happens. I'm just messing around. I don't know. Maybe I will never come back again, right? So we'll see if you have it. These are the kind of things, anyway, that I like to teach on retreat, because that is where you have the extra time to go into detail. I can't say all the details tonight, unless you want to be here till 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Is that too long? Okay, not too long in the morning. Okay, but fine. So we're going to keep it short then. Yeah. So, but these things are important, and you can now start to see the scope of Buddhist morality is incredibly wide and incredibly deep. And if you practice all of that, including the purification of your mind, we must be compassionate and kindness to all beings everywhere, you can see how pure you become. Yeah, very, very pure, very beautiful mind, very bright inside. And of course, this is why this is so powerful, the sila is so powerful, the morality is so powerful. And this is why if you do this fully, this takes you almost to the end of the path in its own right. It takes you straight into meditation. When you meditate with that kind of mind, bam, you kind of hit the kind of a jackpot straight away, yeah? And you kind of, whoa, go into deep states of samadhi so quickly if you practice in this particular way. Yeah? So this is why that commitment, the perseverance in the area of sila, of this kindness, avoiding the badness, why this is so fundamental. And if we can commit to this, if we really can commit to this, then we're going to make incredibly rapid progress on the path. So the question then is, how can we commit to this? It was a very interesting question. I was just leading this retreat outside of Hamburg, just 9 days, and one of the people said, but how can we be kind? Yeah, how can we be consistently kind? This is a very good question, because kindness sometimes is easy, sometimes is difficult, but consistency in kindness is actually very difficult. And the next thing I'm going to tell you about is why it is so hard. Yeah, I'm going to let that hang as well until we get the translation by Paul, first of all, there.
Het moeilijkste in de praktijk is, is de praktijk. Inzicht in de natuur van de werkelijkheid met Nibbana als het resultaat. Het hoogste vorm van geluk bereiken. Hoe komt het dat zo weinig mensen daarin slagen? Hoe komt het dat er zo weinig arahants zijn? Precies omwille van een gebrek aan toewijding en doorzettingsvermogen. Lezen en studie is eigenlijk heel eenvoudig, maar dit is het moeilijke punt. Toewijding en doorzetting. Wat bedoelen we precies met toewijding? Bijvoorbeeld op het vlak van moraliteit of ethiek of zin in het Pali. Als we boeddhistische moraliteit kunnen beoefenen, dan vallen de andere dingen op hun plek. Van moment tot moment, van dag op dag, van jaar op jaar. En dan komen de resultaten van het pad snel. Moraliteit kan zich afspelen in verschillende, of speelt zich af op verschillende vlakken, op het domein van het lichaam, moraliteit van het lichaam. Wat betekent bijvoorbeeld elke vorm van leven respecteren, niet doden, niet stelen en geen seksueel wangedrag plegen. Moraliteit van de spraak, wat betekent niet liegen, geen harde of kletsende taal gebruiken en geen zinloos geklets of gestrets of geplaatst idle talk. Moraliteit gaat niet alleen over wat we zouden moeten vermijden, het gaat ook over wat we actief zouden moeten doen. Bijvoorbeeld vrijgevigheid. Een algemene attitude van vrijgevigheid betekent een openheid van het hart. En dat is wat echt belangrijk is, deze kwaliteit van openheid van het hart. Dus is een negatieve kwaliteit, of er is negatieve moraliteit, datgene wat we zouden moeten vermijden, en er is positieve moraliteit, datgene wat we zouden moeten cultiveren. Bijvoorbeeld, bij spraak, morele spraak brengt mensen bij elkaar in plaats van mensen te verdelen. Het creëert harmonie. Vooral bij de mensen die dicht bij ons staan. Praat ook over dingen die zin hebben, die waardevol zijn. Als we moraliteit beoefenen, als we op een morele manier leven, dan hebben we geen gevoel van spijt of van schuld. Je voelt je goed over jezelf. En dat is een goed ding, het is goed. Het is positief om een goed gevoel te hebben over jezelf. In sommige culturen, en dan in Engeland, is dat niet het geval. Daar is het, is het een beetje ongehoord om op een positieve manier over jezelf te denken, maar dat klopt niet. Het gaat over de rust, over de stilte, de tevredenheid van het hart. En het is goed om aan te voelen. Dus dat kunnen we bereiken door de slechte of de negatieve acties los te laten, weg te snijden, zoals hij letterlijk, en goede acties in de plaats te stellen. En dat brengt lichtheid en vreugde in ons leven. Dat is wat moraliteit doet. En dan is er de moraliteit van de geest, bijvoorbeeld het overwinnen van boosheid, of slechts de tendency hebben, ill will, dat is heel destructief. Het cultiveren van gedachten van vriendelijkheid bijvoorbeeld, het loslaten van boosheid en het ontwikkelen van een geest van vriendelijkheid, dat is van belang. Dat hele gezamme van boeddhistische moraliteit, of dat hele domein van boeddhistische moraliteit, is heel breed en diep. En moraliteit is heel krachtig. Het neemt je daarna mee naar het einde van het pad. En daardoor, of daarom, is toewijding en volharding zo belangrijk, zo fundamenteel om progressie te maken, om vooruitgang te maken op het pad.
Explain why it is so difficult, right, to have this kind of commitment, this kind of consistency of involvement all the time. Why is this so hard? And the reason why this is so hard has to do with the Buddhist idea of non-self, anatta. You heard about this idea, Buddhist idea of non-self? Yeah. It's one of the core Buddhist ideas of the Buddhist teaching, this idea that when you look inside of yourself, ultimately, the purpose of meditation is to come into very deep states of meditation and then to see the reality of your mind and the body as it actually is. Yeah, it's kind of the significance of insight on the Buddhist path, understanding yourself as you actually are, understanding all people as they actually are. And one of the profound insights the Buddha said that you will have when you do that. The Buddha has gone this path before, so he kind of tells us, okay, if you do try to do this and see what happens, and this is the result you're going to get. And one of the things that you see is that there is no essence inside of you. Yeah, there's no core, there's no permanent essence there. There's nothing which actually is kind of a guide which always drives you in a certain way. The final eye which always has the final say and ensures that you move in the right direction. And kind of is independent of the phenomena in the world. And because it's independent, it can kind of take you in the right direction regardless of the influence you have. The Buddha said there is no such thing, there is no essential core to you. And because there is no essential core to us, according to the Buddha, assuming that that is correct, then what we are as people, we are the sum of those causes and conditions that have worked on us in this life and also in previous lives. Yeah, all of those conditions that have worked on us, that is what we are now, that is what our personality is, that is what we are as human beings. If there is no core, then everything is a matter of cause and condition. You see what I mean? Yeah? Does that make sense? So, this is kind of getting into the deep end of Buddhism, right? But it actually is very interesting because it has some very, very practical implications. And that is why I say this, and even though this is very a deep part of Buddhism, it has some very practical implications. And what it means is that, and I'll give you a simile to explain to you what this actually means. Who you are as a person is just a sum total of all the conditions and causes that have worked on you in this life and in previous lives. It is a bit like you are a ship on the ocean. Now imagine yourself, you are a ship on the ocean, right? So imagine yourself as a ship for a while there. So you have a big hull, right, all those kind of things. And you're sitting there on the big ocean, there's no land in sight anywhere. But this is a different kind of ship. This is a ship without any steering mechanism. There's nothing to steer. There's no engine. There is no rudder. There is no propeller. There is no oars. There is no sail. There is no paddle. There's nothing to steer. All there is the kind of the shape of the ship, the hull of the ship, with nothing else. There's no steering mechanism. If there is no steering mechanism, where is that ship going to go? Where it's going to go? It's going to go dependent on the causes and conditions. If the wind comes from the west, the ship is going to go to the east. If the wind comes from the south, the ship is going to go to the north. If the current comes from the north, the ship is going to go to the south. All of these causes and conditions, the wind, the current, maybe a shark coming pushing it along, yeah, whatever it is, right, any causes and conditions that are there, these are the sum total of those conditions that are going to decide which way that ship goes.
And human beings are a bit like that. We're like a ship in the ocean that is drifting around, not really having any particular direction. And because of that, we get reborn in one family, we have certain parents, but they're influenced in one way. Next life, we get different set of parents, they happen to be Muslims, so you become a Muslim. Next life, you have atheist parents, you become an atheist. Next life, you have Martian parents, so you become a Martian. So it all depends on the influence on us, what actually happens, and which way we go. So this is then very, very interesting, because what it shows us, that if you want that shift on the ocean, which is driven by the currents and the wind, if you want to go to land A, there's different land, different countries around there, if you want a ship, maybe there's a cargo on board, you want to take your cargo to land A, maybe to Belgium, land B, right? Land B, Belgium. So how do you get to Belgium? Well, the only way that you get to Belgium is if the wind comes from the right direction. Yeah, that's the only way you're going to get there. So what you have to do is you have to put that ship in the place whereby the wind comes from the right direction. So it takes you to Belgium. You come to Antwerp, you kind of come to the harbor out here. I'm not sure which way, but somewhere out here. Yeah, that is what you have to do. And you have to make sure the current is about right. You have to make sure there's not too many whales and things on the way are going to block the ship or whatever, I don't know. And then when all of those conditions are right, you put the ship in the right spot, then the ship will come to Belgium, come to Antwerp, and will unload its cargo of, I don't know what kind of cargo you want to unload here. Okay, just forget about that. It's kind of irrelevant. So you unload your cargo in Belgium, and then everything is fine. In exactly the same way, if you are a human being, there's no self inside, there's no rudder, there's no steel mechanism inside of you that drives you in a certain direction. You have to ensure that those causes and conditions that work on you are those causes and conditions that take you forward on the spiritual path. Yeah? The causes and conditions that move you in the right direction towards happiness, away from suffering, towards nirvana, towards the ending of all the defilements of the mind, towards awakening itself. So you have to make sure you put yourself into those causes and conditions. Yeah? So, what are those causes and conditions that take you to nirvana in this way? So I'm going to, surprise, I'm going to stop there again. Because this is kind of the fun, right, of being a teacher, having kind of keep the suspense a little bit. So, I'm going to hand over to Paul again, so you can translate a bit. There.
Is de toewijding en doorzetting zo moeilijk? Het heeft te maken met Ananda in jezelf. En dat betekent eigenlijk dat je begrijpt wat of wie je bent. Dat er geen permanente essentie is, geen kern, geen ik dat onafhankelijk bestaat van de fenomenen in de wereld. We zijn de som van de oorzaken en omstandigheden. En dat is waar onze persoonlijkheid van afhangt. Dat is waar onze persoonlijkheid door wordt bepaald. En dat is heel interessant dat we de som zijn van de oorzaken en de omstandigheden. Want dat heeft een heel praktische gevolg. Wie ben je eigenlijk als persoon? Je bent als een schip op de oceaan zonder een stuurmechanisme. Je bent alleen maar de vorm van een schip. Waar ga je naartoe? Omdat er geen stuurmechanisme is, hangt het af van de oorzaken en omstandigheden, de wind, stroming, die bepalen waar het schip naartoe gaat. Dus de totale som van de condities en de omstandigheden bepaalt waar het schip naartoe gaat. De invloeden determineren de richting die het schip uitgaat. Als je naar land A of land B zoals België gaat, moet je er zeker van zijn dat de wind uit de juiste richting waait. Als menselijk wezen is het dus belangrijk er zeker van te zijn dat de oorzaken en de omstandigheden ons brengen in de juiste richting. En wat is de juiste richting? Dat is de richting van ontwaking, nirvana. En wat zijn nu die omstandigheden of die oorzaken die ons bij nirvana brengen?
Interesting to listen to you because a lot of Dutch words I like to say as Norwegian, I did not recognize it. They were Orsanke.
Orsanke.
Orsanke, what we have to do. That's very close to the end. Okay. So, what do we have to do then? What are these causes and conditions that we have to cultivate to make sure that the ship of our mind, the ship of our personality is headed in the right direction? What is it that we have to do? And of course, I'm sure you may know this already, but obviously what we need to do is to make sure that we get teachings, teachings that teach us those things that actually allow you to head in the right direction. That is the source, that is the cause to bring you in the right direction. And this is very interesting because one of the things that the Buddha says in the suttas and his early discourses was very fascinating. I remember reading this the first time and I thought, does it make sense? I'm not sure if this makes sense. So, and what the story is, and it's a very famous story from the suttas, and if you like this kind of little thing that you may enjoy reading the suttas yourself, I would recommend you to have a look at the early suttas. It's actually very inspiring. And Paul, you would know about the suttas because you were monk before, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you would know about all those
people. Here in the library.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. Afterwards, we'll take them out and show them to you to know exactly what they look like. Yeah. So, this story from the sutta is a story of a Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda, he was the attendant of the Buddha for over 20 years. Always looking after the Buddha. He had a very powerful memory. So he memorized all the teachings of the Buddha as they were given. I don't know how people can do that, but that's what they did in those days, listening and memorizing straight away, right? So after the talk is given, you can verbatim kind of say it again. If I ask one of you to say what I said verbatim, impossible, right? I can't even do that. No way I can do that. Say it straight again. So that is the kind of the ability of memory that people had because they were trained in that at that time to some extent. That was kind of how that society worked, if you like. Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, Master, Blessed One, Lord, I have come to the conclusion, I understand that 50% of the holy life is the spiritual life, if you like it, 50% of the spiritual life is having good friends. Kalyana Mitta is the Pali word, a very important Pali word. 50% of the spiritual life is this idea of having Kalyana Mitta, good spiritual friends. In other words, he said it's really important to have the right kind of people around, to meet, in a nice group like this with like-minded people, to have good teachers. This is so fundamental. That is what he's saying to the Buddha. Because, of course, number one, Kalyanamitta, number one good spiritual friend is, of course, the Buddha. He's number one. And then you have other people who have insight into the teaching. They'll also be very high Kalyanamitta. And then everyone else who supports you in your practice. But what does the Buddha reply? This is kind of fascinating, right? What do you think the Buddha says? When Ananda says, 50% of the spiritual life is Kalyanamitta. Sounds like too much. How can it be 50%? What about all the other things? You're supposed to be virtuous, you're supposed to be compassionate and kind, you're supposed to do meditation practice, you're supposed to be peaceful, generous. How can Kalyanamitta be 50%? Surely, Ananda must be exaggerating it. So maybe the Buddha says, maybe he says 20%. Maybe he says something completely different. So what do you think the Buddha says? You know the answer already? You know the answer already? And so he says it's 100%.
And this is what is so interesting about this, because when I read that first time, I thought, sure, it's 100%, yeah, the Buddha is exaggerating, right? Of course it's like, it can't be 100%. We all know there's more to the spiritual life than hanging out with good friends. Yeah, just go on and having a cup of coffee with a good spiritual friend, that's not going to be 100% of the spiritual life. But of course, after having been a monk for, I've been a monk over 20 years now, right? So after one, wait a minute, the Buddha says nothing. Buddha don't just go around exaggerating, right? If they say something, usually there is a meaning behind that. That is what I invite you to. When you start to read the suttas, all the word Buddha in a broader context, and you start to understand how this works, and this is what I was just saying right now about the idea of non-self, that there is no brother inside of you. If there is no brother inside of you, then the conditioning, where you are going, whether you're heading in the right way or not, is 100% dependent on the right external conditioning. Yeah? Conditioning from a teacher who has understood the truth is 100% dependent on that. So if you look at it that way, then the Buddha is absolutely right. It is 100% of the spiritual life to have a Kalyanamitta. Without that somebody who has that insight, who has walked the path before you, there is no way you're going to get there. Yeah, because you need somebody who has had that insight. Assuming that the Buddha had a special insight. For me, the Buddha is the greatest spiritual genius in human history. There's nobody above, nobody on his side. He is number one because of that profound, especially profound insight that he had into the nature of phenomena. So you need that to be able to go all the way on the path through the way the Buddha did that. And this is why it is 100%, yeah? So I thought I was going to catch you all out, because if you knew the answer, that was a bit of a bit disappointing. Anyway, the way it goes with these things. Now we start to understand what it is you have to do to commit and persevere. Then, what you have to do is you have to go back to the Buddha. You have to hang out with the Buddha. You have to make the Buddha your friend. Yeah, you can do that then. People say, how can make the Buddha pass the way through? How can he? You must be kidding. How can he be my friend? And of course, the point is that the Buddha is still here in terms of the suttas. We still have his discourses, yeah? The word of the Buddha is still available to us. So make use of that. Sometimes you may be happy to ask Paul to have a class about some of the suttas in here. I'm making more work for you, Paul. I apologize. But so I don't know how you work as a community, but that might be very interesting to look at some of these basic, maybe you're doing it already now, some of these basic suttas.
Sutta classes, you mean?
Yeah, no, that we you don't do that. Simple ones. No,
we regularly invite monks like you just to have them on Friday.
Okay. Good. So yeah. Anyway, if you have something going there, that's good. So probably there's always a little bit extra from the sutras in those talks, right? So it means that you get something anyway from the sutras. So that I would really recommend you to have a little bit of look at those sutras. It does not have to be the sutras. Sometimes you can listen to good Dhamma talks as well. But the problem is sometimes you're not really sure what are the good Dhamma talks, what are the bad ones. Right now, you're listening to me, right? Maybe I was talking a lot of rubbish. They would have said it's complete nonsense. How do you know? And the way to know is actually to go to the Buddha and compare what I say to what the Buddha said. And if it doesn't match, and the Buddha says, you know, the spiritual life is zero, or the Kalamanita is 0% of the spiritual life, then of course you know that I'm talking nonsense, yeah? And this is really how we can decide actually on the spiritual teachings in the end as well, by returning to the gold standard. The yardstick by which everything else which can measure is really the sutras of the Buddha. So you need to allow yourself to be influenced by that. Listen also to good teachers who actually align themselves with the teachings of the Buddha. And as you do that, you allow that conditioning to happen, which makes you condition in such a way that you move towards nirvana, you move towards greater happiness, you move away from suffering. Yeah, what you are doing here? Yeah, this is going to come as a shock to you, right? Are you ready for a shock? What you're doing here is that you are brainwashing yourself. Are you ready to be brainwashed then? Anybody wants to be brainwashed then? Nobody wants to be brainwashed, right? It's always like that. But The point here, this is kind of the interesting thing about this idea of non-self, is that we are really brainwashed anyway. This is the whole point of non-self. If you are the sum total of the causes and conditions that work on you, then that's exactly what you are. You are brainwashed. Your personality is the sum total of these, all these external things that come inside of you. Why do you have certain political views? Why do you have certain religious views? Why do you have certain views about anything? Because of the conditioning that has come into your life. So we are already brainwashed. So what you need to make sure is that you use brainwashing that is good. Good brainwashing. There's bad brainwashing, good brainwashing. Use a good one. Yeah? If you use it like a washing machine, good washing powder, bad washing powder. Try to get some good washing powder. The Buddha still changes it. Yeah? Give it a good rinse, take out your brain, check it in, put it back in again, comes out nice and clean. And then you move towards Nirvana at the cost of words. So brainwashing is the point I'm making is not that, you know, I want to brainwash or anything like that. The point is that brainwashing happens regardless. So we have to ensure that we actually get conditioned in the right way. And then we move in the right direction. Then we head in to where it is advantageous for us and beneficial for us to actually move them. Okay, Paul, I'm going to give you a chance now, otherwise
Wat zijn die oorzaken en condities die we cultiveren om ons in de juiste richting, om het schip in de juiste richting te laten varen? We hebben behoefte aan onderricht en de soetas zijn een belangrijke bron. Het eerwaarde Ananda, de monnik, had een fenomenaal geheugen en hij memoriseerde alles wat de toespraak van de Boeddha. Hij was daarin getraind. En hij zei: Heer, 50% van het heilige leven, van het spirituele leven, is het hebben van spirituele vrienden. Kalyanamita in de Pali, goede vrienden, dat is heel belangrijk. En die mensen dachten, de andere monniken dachten hij overdrijft, zeker. Maar de Boeddha zei: nee, het is geen 50%, het is 100%. Dus het spirituele pad is voor 100%, bestaat voor 100% uit het vinden van goede spirituele vrienden. Non-self of ananda of geen zelf betekent dat waar je naartoe gaat voor 100% afhangt van uitwinnige factoren. En dat is het belang van Kalyanamita, van spirituele verbinding in gezelschap. Die zet je op een bepaald spoor, die laat je een bepaalde richting uitgaan. We kunnen beginnen met de Boeddha onze goede vriend te maken. We kunnen beginnen met in het gezelschap van de Boeddha te vertoeven. Ik raad jullie aan om de soetas te lezen. Ik raad jullie aan om te luisteren naar goede dana-talks en jezelf toe te laten om daardoor beïnvloed te worden door die gunstige invloeden, door die gunstige conditionering zou je kunnen zeggen. Dus laat jezelf toe om die conditionering te laten gebeuren. En wat je hier eigenlijk doet, is dat je jezelf laat brainwashen. Je persoonlijkheid is het resultaat van het proces van brainwashing. En dat is het altijd. Er is goede en slechte brainwashing, heilzame en onheilzame brainwashing. Maar brainwashing gebeurt altijd. Dus het is van belang dat je in het gezelschap bent van mensen die in de juiste richting, in de goede richting, richting Nirvana laten evolueren.
Oké. Okay. So it's good that you are so efficient, Paul, because otherwise we'll give you enough time to take a break.
I'm going to just say one last thing. This is that I'm going to give you a simile that explains this in a very nice way. This again, it's one of the beautiful things when you read the suttas of the Buddha. It is lots of very nice similes and stories, that sort of thing. And sometimes they're very powerful, very beautiful. And one of the things that I enjoy a lot about reading the word of the Buddha. But this particular simile is showing us the importance of listening to the word of the Buddha, having good kalyanamitta, being around people who have understood these teachings properly through insight and through their own practice. And what he says is that that is like the rain falling on the mountaintop, yeah? When the rain falls on the mountaintop and it keeps on falling, after a while it forms into streams, yeah? And when the streams fall and the rain keeps falling, the streams go into larger streams. And if the rain keeps falling, those larger streams, they go into little lakes. And as the rain keeps falling, those little lakes become full, and they overflow into large lakes. And eventually, if the rain continues, those large lakes also overflow, and they go into the large rivers. And eventually, those large rivers reach the ocean itself. In exactly the same way, the rain is like listening to these teachings, trying to understand what they're about. Yeah? As you listen to these teachings, as you take an interest in them, it is raining upon the mountaintop. So you keep the rain going, keep on listening, and listening, and listening. Going back, listening to the sutta, listening to a nice discourse here, a nice discourse there from teachers who know what they're talking about. And as the rain keeps coming down like that, gradually you're moving towards Nibbana as a consequence. First of all, you start thinking in the right way. Your view kind of gets sorted out. You start to have the right view about how the world functions. You start to become more compassionate and kind. Your sila, your morality is developing. And as all of these things are building up and building up, you keep on raining and raining and raining on the mountaintop. And eventually, as a consequence, your meditation takes off. And when your meditation takes off, you finally have those insights that take you all the way to awakening itself. All you have to do, the most important thing, the most foundational thing, the foundation, the basis upon which everything else is built, and upon which everything else depends, is keep that rain coming on the mountaintop. That is what the Buddha says. That rain is a continuous listening to, investigating, and trying to understand these teachings. And then, eventually, you will come there. So that is the cause and the way, if you want to commit yourself on the spiritual path, especially the Buddhist path, and if you want to be able to persevere and you want to kind of make good progress, that is the answer directly from the word of the Buddha itself. That is how you get there. And that is how commitment and perseverance happens on this path. And that is all I'm going to say. And I thought I was going to maybe open up for a few questions as well. I thought I'd talk way too much, but
Should I translate?
Please translate, of course. Yeah.
Is there a few questions maybe, or maybe one?
Yeah.
Since we only have 5 minutes
after that.
Okay. Is een heel mooi beeldspraak die Boeddha gebruikt over het hebben van goede spirituele vrienden. Hij zegt dat je kan een ander rondje met de regen die neerkomt op een bergtop. En als de regen blijft komen, dan ontstaan er stromen en de stromen worden breder en een brede stroom wordt uiteindelijk een meer en dat meer wordt nog groter en uiteindelijk ontstaat er een grote rivier en komt het water terecht in de oceaan. Dus de regen is zoals het luisteren naar het onderricht. Als de regen blijft komen, dan reis je in de richting van Nibbana. Dan komt je meditatie echt tot ontplooiing en dan krijg je inzichten. Dus het hele punt is keep that rain coming. Dus zorg ervoor dat de regen blijft naar beneden komen. blijf, met andere woorden, blijf jezelf openstellen voor die invloeden, voor het onderricht. Blijf luisteren naar het onderricht en onderzoek. Dat is de weg van commitment en perseverance, van toewijding en doorzetting.
Okay. Actually, one more thing I'd like to add, Paul. I'm so terrible if I'm not allowing any kind of conversation here, but I just like to summarize very briefly, because sometimes if you don't summarize, people think, oh, that was a, you know, what is really important here. Some of the things I've been saying. So just let me just summarize very, very quickly what I've been saying here. And the first is two things you should take away from this talk, yeah? The first thing is kindness. Kindness is so important. If you can remember that one word, kindness, in your life, it means basically all the morality, all of those things that fall into place as a consequence of life. So all you really have to remember is the word kindness. But of course, guess what? You're going to forget that one word, right? Because that is what the life is like. We're all like that. You get busy, you do things, and before you know it, that is forgotten. So when you forget the word kindness, there's another thing you should not forget. Yeah? And that is, always come back to those teachings. Come back to those talks that support you, those talks that you find inspiring, that help you to move in the right direction. Go back to that, to those again. Give yourself a little bit of a brainwashing. Clean out the bad stuff, yeah? And then the kindness will return as a consequence. Those two things are really all you have to remember. If you can do that, it will go a long way on this path, yeah? So enjoy and have fun.
Okay, samenvatting. Er zijn maar twee dingen die je zou moeten meenemen van deze aanpak. Dat is ten eerste vriendelijkheid en dat houdt ook in moraliteit. En ten tweede, kom altijd terug naar die onderricht, laat je altijd opnieuw inspireren en geef jezelf dit soort van brainwashing keer op keer. En dat gaat je heel veel brengen op het pad.